You're listening to Truth To You Radio with Jono on truth2u.org. That's truth2u.org, where you can also sign up for the weekly newsletter and keep up to date via iTunes, Facebook, and Twitter. G'day to Elvira, as well as John in Buckley, Washington, who commented on Treasures from the Tanakh on Facebook. Also, Frank from Berlin, who commented on Treasures from the Tanakh on the website. And Gail, who wrote, "Thank you so much for doing this. It's nice to get a perspective from someone who knows Hebrew and can shed light on difficult passages. Praise Yehovah for sending good teachers our way. And thank you, Jono, for giving them a place to teach from, to teach thousands, to reach thousands around the globe." And Shelley, who commented, Shelley said, "I've been having quite an issue with the whole Satan thing since I started studying the word because of a teaching I heard here on Truth To You." Now, that's probably, I'm guessing that's Yoel's teaching. He and I had a discussion entitled Hell, Hades, and Hasatan. And also, she goes on to say, and what Nehemiah had to say in regards to the angel and Balaam. That would have been the Torah Pearls section on Numbers chapter 22. "After hearing this today, I am even more at odds with my previous belief. This is not a bad thing in my mind. It's a good thing. I just wish I understood it better." She goes on to say, "Thanks for this teaching. I really, really appreciate it." It is, of course, time for Treasures from the Tanakh with Torah teacher Ira Michelson. Welcome back, Ira.
G'day, Jono.
G'day, my friend. It's great to have you back on. And, of course, the character of Satan continues on where we are in the book of Job. We're kicking off from Job chapter 2. And I have to admit, you know, I know where Shelley's coming from. I remember when I was dealing with all of this and just ironing it all out in my brain because of the tradition where I came from, Ira. Satan was very, very important. You had to have the personality, that is, of Satan, the arch enemy of God. And in the religion that I came from, you know, Satan was always trying, I remember this phrase, always trying to get to you. You know, you always had people in the Sunday church saying, "Oh, this week Satan's been trying to get to me." And I always used to think to myself, what in the world does that mean?
Like, I'm under attack.
I'm under spiritual attack. It's like that. It's like, what, is Satan in some other kind of dimension and he wants to somehow figure out a way to get through and get to you and make things bad for you? And I tell you what, my faith became so much calmer and it made so much more sense once I figured out the whole Satan thing. And so I can appreciate where Shelley's coming from.
Yeah, and I think it's funny that that people make it such a big deal about it, as if they're such spiritual giants that all this entity that they believe is the archenemy of God has nothing better to do than to mark them out for attack. I have a funny story about that. As a matter of fact, years ago, I used to live down on South Beach, Miami Beach, which, you know, was old and run down and regentrified, and now it's, gosh, it's like it's ridiculous what the place is like. You know, nightclubs and things like that, and there's all kind of debauchery going on. But I remember years ago going out, and some friends of mine said, "Oh, we're going to go out and play some music on the beach or whatever, and you know, would you like to come?" So I went along with them, and some another guy came running up, and he starts apologizing for being late, and he says, "But the devil attacked me on the way here."
Wait.
And I said, "Really? You were attacked by the devil? I mean, what happened? How did that happen?" He says, "Well, I got a ticket." You got a ticket? What do you mean?" "Well, I got a parking ticket." I said, "You got a parking ticket for what?" And he goes, "I got a parking ticket for illegally parking at a bus stop." And I said, so wait a minute. You're late because you got a parking ticket for illegally parking your car in a bus stop, and you equate that with being attacked by the devil?" And he was quite serious, but this is what we have today. And really what ends up happening is we have this character that we know is completely different from a Hebraic perspective, and the Satan, capital S Satan, really is something that's foreign to the Hebraic perspective in Judaism, and really receives power and receives glorification from those people that have turned him into something that he's not.
Look, I go so far as just, I'm going to say this, I'll get in trouble for it, but I will tell you, I can't believe I'm going to tell you this on air, but you know, once you get to the bottom of it, Ira, I have no problem saying that that Satanism, the movement that is Satanism, is a denomination of Christianity, and that Christianity gets that concept of Satan, I think it would probably be fair to say, from Zoroastrianism. You think that's probably fair?
Yeah, I mean, look, you know, so much of what we of our faith is rooted in these kind of things. I mean, look, even the faith of Israel, when you study the Tanakh, you know, comes as having touched upon or brushing up against paganism and pagan culture. I mean, this is why when the Hebrews come out of Mitzrayim, come out of Egypt, and Yehovah speaks to them and gives them instructions, one of the things he continually says to them is, remember, I don't want you to do the acts of the Egyptians, and I don't want you to do the acts of the people in the land that I'm taking you into. Because they always brushed up against paganism, and so does Christianity. So, so it's not unusual when you brush against those things to, you know, to
some of it's going to rub off,
and some of it, what ends up happening is some of it subtly stays within the belief system. You know, all throughout. You know, I mean, I know we don't want to get into too much into the idea of Christianity, but when you look at early Christianity, when you look at the early church fathers, you see many times, you know, if you study that, you know, people like Marcion and others who were considered heretics, and yet some of their teaching still remained within the, you know, the belief system of modern day Christianity, even though they were considered heretical in their day.
So how embarrassing for the Satanists. Anyway, I would just say to everybody, because, you know, a lot of people, and I was here, I remember thinking like this too, but what about the time that this happened? And what about the time that that happened? Oh, and then there was the time that this thing happened, and oh. But I would say to people, do not underestimate the power of selected attention.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
That's what I'm going to leave them with. Let's move on.
There you go.
There's enough to think about in that sentence.
Absolutely.
Do not underestimate the power of selected attention. Now, here we are in Job chapter 2, and I've got a subheading on my New King James Study Bible, Ira. It says, Satan attacks.
Do you have an asterisk again?
I don't have an asterisk just yet, but there's probably a few. But the direction that it wants me to think is Satan attacks Job's health. Well, let's read the text and see if that's how that actually plays out. It says, again, there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before Yehovah, and Satan, also the adversary, also came along with them to present himself before Yehovah. And Yehovah said to the adversary, from where do you come? And the adversary answered Yehovah, from going to and fro on the earth and from walking back and forth on it. Yehovah said to the adversary, have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, one who fears God and shuns evil, and still, and he's an addition to this description that we keep coming across, it says, and still he holds fast to his integrity. That's a beautiful thing. I love people who hold fast to their integrity. Although you incited me against him to destroy him without cause. So the adversary answered Yehovah and said, skin for skin. Yes, all that the man has he will give for his life. But stretch out your hand now and touch his bone and his flesh. He will surely curse you to your face. Now, so far, what happened in chapter 1 was he lost all of his possessions, really, including his sons and daughters. And it was a terrible thing. One after another, the servants came in and said, this has happened, this has been stolen, this has been destroyed, your sons and have been killed, and terrible stuff. But his health is still, his well-being is still intact. And the adversary says to Yehovah, look, if you touch him, his physical being, then he's going to change his mind. Yehovah said, okay, but don't kill him. And stretch out your hand now and touch him, his bone and his flesh, and he will surely curse you to your face. Yehovah said to Satan, behold, he is in your hand, but spare his life. Ira.
So, you know, like you said, we had these calamities that came upon him last week that we talked about. And one of the things that we talked about last week was this kind of perspective from the rabbis this divine court, or this heavenly court was called, and we compared it to Rosh Hashanah. To the idea of Yom Terah. Rosh Hashanah, also from a Hebraic perspective, is called Yom HaDin, the Day of Judgment. And I thought it was very interesting that we have a second time here in chapter 2 where it happens again. And I thought to myself, how interesting, you know, perhaps we could be dealing with a Rosh Hashanah and a Yom Kippur, that it was, you know, they came first at the, you know, Rosh Hashanah or Yom Terah when the books are opened, and then appeared again a second time on Yom Kippur when it said the books are closed. That's just kind of an interesting take on that. But really what's interesting is that we have this, we have this idea with another heavenly council, and I'm using the term council instead of court this time. Mm-hmm. And we're going to see much later in the text, when we get into the later chapters, we're going to get into all this legal language that we touched on last week, where we said that, you know, there's a lot of legal language. We're going to actually see that, like one of the things we touched on was Job being a king, but we're also going to see perhaps that he was a magistrate, and not just a magistrate, but it also speaks to the idea of kingship as well, because at that time, the kings would have been the ones that would have been magistrates. So, mm-hmm. so we're going to see that later on, but I want to touch on this idea of the heavenly council or the heavenly court, because this is really something that I think that would have been recognized and understood by the people, in that area in ancient times. And specifically this idea of the divine council for the purpose of what we're studying here. Because in essence, it's kind of like the heavenly equivalent of nobility appearing mm-hmm. at the court of a king, which would have been a regular occurrence that we would have seen in an earthly kingdom. You know, and here we get into that idea of kingship again as it relates to Job, but certainly as it relates to this heavenly council. And we know from chapter 1 that these heavenly council meetings were absolutely chaired by the divine king, by Jehovah mm-hmm. himself. But we have another reference to this actually in Tehillim in the Psalms, in Psalm 89 verses 5 through 7, where it reads, "The heavens confess your wonders, Jehovah, also your faithfulness in the assembly of the holy ones. Because who in the clouds is equal to Jehovah, like to Jehovah with the sons of the mighty?" Or it's B'nai Elim instead of B'nai Elohim. And it says, "A God dreaded in the great council of the holy ones and feared above all around him." So well, we see
that's
this.
Interesting. Let me just read what I... Yeah, and this is that verse 7 and 8? I've got here in my translation, "God is greatly to be feared in the assembly of all the saints."
Right.
And to be held in reverence by those all around him, O Jehovah, God of hosts, who is mighty like you, O Jehovah, your faithfulness also surrounds you.
Right, except I was reading to you from a literal translation from the Hebrew, mm-hmm. Which talks about Kahal Kedoshim, assembly of the holy ones, and then mm-hmm. with the sons of, where it would say B'nai Elim, sons of the mighty or sons of God, again we see in Tehillim. Okay, and then it goes again, once again, into council of the holy ones. So first it says assembly of the holy ones, then it talks about the sons of God, and then it talks about a council of holy ones. Uh-huh. And then another really important detail in here is the word translated here as cloud or skies, okay? In the second verse that I read, because who in the clouds is equal to Jehovah? And it's the Hebrew word shachak. And this is not the usual word that we see for sky or heaven. Usually we see shamayim for heavens mm-hmm. That we saw earlier in the verse. And it can also mean to beat fine or to pulverize, or it can mean in a literal meaning of shachak is a cloud of dust. What does that mean? And I told you that eventually we get into, and it didn't take us long, but we get into this very poetic kind of language. Mm-hmm. And we get into these kind of concepts. Both, you know, although this is not directly from Eov, but it's speaking of the same type of situation, which is why I want to bring it. And so we talk about this very strange Hebrew that we see. And there are some that think this dust cloud actually refers to a cloud of stars, or what we would call constellation.
As you're speaking about this, in the English anyway, I've got Psalm 89 verse 6 that you're referring to. And I'm just looking at some notes here, and it says, who in the heavens can be compared to Jehovah?
Right.
It says the Hebrew phrase for the son, I mean, tell me if you agree with this, the Hebrew phrase for the sons of the Almighty may mean sons of gods or heavenly beings.
Right.
The reference could be to other supposed gods or to angels, members of the heavenly court. And then it has a reference back to Job 1:6.
Exactly, which is why I'm bringing this today. So, there is some thought or commentary that talks about, you know, B'nai Elim being, you know, gods as opposed to heavenly beings. But when you look at it in context of that word shachak, if we're seeing something that's really related to this cloud of dust, or what's really referring to constellations or stars, this is very significant as it relates to the Malachim, to the angels or the sons of God that we see, because in the ancient times, the angels or gods were connected with the stars and planets, which really? Is actually supported by some rabbinic texts that we read. And we see this still kind of in a watered down form in modern day astrology. You know, when you consider that, and this is the only way really to make sense of the poetic parallelism here, in which the council of the sons of Elim are compared to the appearance of the stars in the sky. And so here we have a council over which Yehovah reigns supreme.
Oh, well, that's brilliant.
And so now when the council gathers, Satan entices God to allow him to attack Job's person. And this is what we're seeing here. So I think this is, I think that that's really, you know, a great tie-in for what we see in the second council that takes place.
And that's great, because when you were talking about the heavenly council, I thought, oh, okay, so we're going to go to Isaiah chapter 6, or we're going to talk about the passage that we spoke about last week in regards to Micaiah, but you've taken us to Psalm 89, and that is brilliant. I've never seen that before, and I'm really glad that you brought that out and tied it in with what we see in Job chapter 1 and Job chapter 2. That is really good. But while we're there, I may as well read out Isaiah 6, just the relevant passage. Is that okay?
Sure, absolutely.
So in the year of King Uzziah, that the King Uzziah died, I saw, this is Isaiah, I saw Yehovah sitting on a throne, high and lifted up, and the train of his robe filled the temple, and above it stood seraphim, each one having six wings, and two he covered his face, and two he covered his feet, and two he flew, and one cried to another, "Holy, holy, holy is Yehovah of hosts, the whole earth is full of his glory." And the posts of the doors were shaken by the voice of him who cried out, and the house was filled with smoke. And I said, "Oh, woe is me, I am undone, because I am a man of unclean lips, and I dwell in the midst of a people of unclean lips. My eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts."
Amen.
Yeah, there it is. And so, he actually gets to see it. Not only that, but he gets to converse in this heavenly congregation. He talks with them and he speaks with Yehovah. Not so in the case of Micaiah that we read last week. He gets to see, he gets to observe, and he gets to hear. But here Isaiah gets to speak, and so it's another interesting passage. But here they are, and they are conversing, and the adversary says, "If you touch him, things will change." And so Yehovah says, "Okay, behold, he is in your hand, but spare his life." So here again is another direct commandment. And, of course, the angel cannot do anything past what he's commanded to do. Is that fair?
Yeah, sure. And look, you know, there's even sometimes just a slight different change in the English changes the whole thing. I mean, something as simple as, you know, if you say, "And Satan also came and presented himself before Yehovah." But if you read it in the Hebrew, it says that the B'nei HaElohim, the sons of God, came to stand before Yehovah, and also Satan came to stand before Yehovah. So it wasn't like kind of this grand presentation. I mean, this was a natural thing in the heavenly court, as you read in Isaiah chapter 6, and as we see in these two divine councils that are called here. So I don't see this as really some really significant thing. And some people make a big deal about the fact that Satan was separated out from the rest of them. You know, this is the typical argument that comes why he's, you know, not considered part of the good guys and part of the bad guys, is that, you know, why didn't he come together with them? Well, the truth of the matter is that he's got a completely different job description than the rest of them do. You know, he's the adversary.
He's the adversary, but the other thing, of course, is that he is he's a major role of the story.
Yeah, he's a major role of the story, but his job description really, you know, places him functioning within the earthly realm, which is what we see, and not necessarily with the earthly realm to be, you know, the arch enemy of God that we're talking about, but to do just what he's doing here, you know, which is, you know, when God says to him, when Yehovah says to him, "Have you considered my servant Eov, my servant Job?" Of course he has. That's his job. He's been out there roaming around looking. And so, you know, this is why he was able to come with the things. I mean, how did he know about Job? How did he know that he had wealth? How did he know he had these children? How did he know all the things that he said to Yehovah, you know, take away these things and let's see what happens. And so now we come into these verses where he says, skin for skin, okay? All right, you've already let me take away his wealth. You've let me take away his children. You know, he's sitting there and he hasn't cursed you yet, but now let's talk about this. Skin for skin. And this kind of sounds familiar in our modern day kind of expressions, you know, which is biblical as well. We see this in the book of Shemot in Exodus, the idea of an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And so we see that Satan asks Yehovah to strike Job with some type of disease, convinced that this is going to be the very thing that causes him to curse God.
Mm.
And so as you said, he says, and Yehovah said to the adversary, look, he is in your hand, okay? He doesn't remember, Satan said, you know, you touch him, you know, with your hand and see what happens. But he doesn't say that. Yehovah says, okay, you know what? I'm not going to touch him. I'm going to give you the power to do it. He's in your hand. However, guard his soul, okay? Mm-hmm. Guard his soul. In other words, you're not able to kill him. You have to preserve him. And it says that the adversary in verse 7 went out from the presence of Yehovah and struck Job with what?
Painful boils is what I've got.
Painful boils from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. Painful boils. So guess what? Guess what that is? So if you look at those painful boils, you know, one of the things that we see is that it relates to something you and I talked about last week, you know, that I touched on when we were talking about, you know, the idea of what's written and what's read, you know, as it relates to words like Alephim. And here we see in verse 7 that this word is, it says, Vayetze ha-satan me'et p'nei Yehovah, vayach et Yov bishchin ra mikaf raglo ad kadkado. Okay, so bishchin or shchin is this is that word that translated as inflammation there. Okay. And it says that the association there is with the boils that come from the use of the same word, because we see the same word that's used to describe one of the plagues that's brought on Egypt.
In Exodus chapter 9.
But there it was a type of inflammation that went into more detail, because there it says it broke out into boils or blisters. And however, this is what's interesting. When you look at this word shechin, and we look at it in Leviticus, in Vayikra, in Leviticus 13, in verses 18, 19, and 20, We see the same word used. It says, "Uvasar ki yeh bo be'oro shechin v'nerfa," which means when the body has a boil on it, its skin and it is healed.
So we're talking about a type of leprosy?
We're talking about leprosy.
Why do we have to talk about leprosy again?
Okay, why do we have to talk about leprosy again?
Oh, my word.
So here
I mean, in Leviticus, we don't, it's not conclusive that the type of leprosy that's being spoken about in Leviticus is the type of, is what we call leprosy today.
Right.
But whatever it is, my goodness, it's pretty gruesome. And the details that we have in Leviticus, I mean, we have a couple of chapters on it, right? I mean,
yeah, ooh. And, you know, this whole idea of, you know, when we go into Metzorah and Tazria and things like that, where we talk about you know, what the rabbis called Tzara'at, you know, which they believe is a disease, an outward condition that's as a result of an inward disease. And that's the idea of Lashon Hara, you know, the idea of the evil tongue. But it's interesting that we tie this in, because every time we, not every time, but at least in the Torah, what we're looking here is that we see this word Shechin related to this concept of leprosy, and sometimes very much associated with the judgment of God. And we saw that specifically in Numbers chapter 12 with Miriam.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Miriam breaks out as a result of the judgment of Yehovah upon her for her speaking
against Moses and sort of enticing or seemingly enticing Aaron to do the same thing. And she suffered the consequences of that 7 days. And it may have been for the rest of her life if it wasn't for Moses who interceded on her behalf. But here it is that he is, it says, from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head, and he took for himself a broken piece of pottery?
It is just that, a broken piece of pottery.
With which to scrape himself. Oh, it's just so gruesome.
It's horrible.
It's horrible. With which to scrape himself while he sat in the midst of ashes.
Right. So there we have Job, the most famous guy. He's upright. He's Ish Tam. And here he is sitting among the ashes, scraping his disfigured skin with a broken piece of pottery. It makes me shudder.
Just it does.
About it makes me shudder. The hair on the back of my neck is going up.
Yeah, no, that's right. So verse 7 and 8 is just so gruesomely described. It's so visual. Let's move on.
But no, wait a minute. This is important. We can't move on. We have to stay in this horrible condition because I think there's something.
With Job for a bit.
Yeah, so but think about this, okay? Think about this for a second. Mm. Look at what's being said in verse 8 and think to yourself, where could this potentially be taking place?
Where?
Yeah,
that's a really good. Okay, so he's sitting in the ashes.
Ashes and broken pottery. Where would this be?
Two things come to mind. I mean, we've already read how Job would offer sacrifices and stuff like that, but I don't know that he'd be sitting in the midst of a place where he offers sacrifices.
Nope.
I think, if anywhere, he's going to be sitting in a place where he burns rubbish.
Ah, here we go. So one could make the argument that the ashes and the broken pottery put us directly in the garbage dump of an ancient city or village.
You had to make it worse, didn't you?
I had to make it worse because we're talking about Satan. How can we talk about Satan and not talk about hell?
Well, now, oh my goodness. But we have so much, we have it when we talk about imagery and we talk about the Valley of Tophet and or Gehenna, and you know, otherwise known in the Christian world as hell,
right?
And you know, where the garbage dump, where the worm dieth not. Hell is worm heaven, by the way. Where the worm dieth not, and the worm lives forever. It's good for the worm, but and the fire is not quenched. And you can imagine there's a place of ashes and disease and brokenness and. Ugh.
Right. So you have to in this imagery realize that. You know, in these dumps, as in many parts of the world, even today, refuse was constantly being burned. I mean, we don't consider it because we live in kind of civilized countries. You know, in Australia, I'm sure where you live in New South Wales, you don't see this. And I certainly don't see this in the U.S., I'm sure. But in third world countries, we see this. Mm. And because of this continual burning and the refuse, the main garbage dump in Jerusalem, in Yerushalayim, in the Gehinnom Valley, is used in Scripture and by rabbis as an image of hell, right?
Mm-hmm. Amen.
So where would we see somebody who had a disease that would either be leprosy or be something like leprosy? Where would the lepers tend to congregate? They would congregate in these dumps.
Mm.
As with the poor in many countries today. So I think the imagery is really, you know, I didn't want to go really past that.
But that makes perfect sense, Ira. I mean, does not Leviticus describe them as set apart, right?
Yeah, because they wouldn't be allowed to enter the city or village because of fear of infection. People would be afraid of that. Certainly there were no doctors, antibiotics. So I think we can say safely that Job, the great man from the East, the greatest man on earth, one of great wealth, is now a leper who is living a hellish existence, that he's an outcast, and he's separated by his disease from all normal human life. And then what does
as if it couldn't get any worse, Ira, as if it couldn't get any worse. You know, and if only he could have been separated from everyone, but no. Then, in verse 9, it says, then his wife said to him, oh, man. And if ever you wanted a word of encouragement in your life, it just wasn't going to happen for Job. His wife, the one that in the darkest moments for most married people, you want an encouraging word from your spouse. But here, which would make all the difference in the world, but here his wife says to him, she basically says, you're done for. Just get it over and done with because you're so disgusting. She says, do you still hold fast to your integrity? Curse God and die. What is she saying? What does that sentence mean to him?
Well, I don't know. Don't Christians call that the gift of encouragement? I mean, look, the guy has lost his wealth, his livestock, his kids, and the closest person left to him on earth, the closest person, tells him to curse God and die. In other words, it would be better to die and get it over with than to go on like this, to live in this hellish experience. And that's why I thought it was important to have the imagery, because, you know, it's one thing if you kind of see, oh, you know, he's sitting outside the house, you know, uses the ashes from the fire. But no, if this guy is in that kind of hellish experience, if he's living in the garbage dump and now he's, you know, using broken pottery to, you know, to the point that he's disfigured, you know, and we're going to get to it in a bit. You know, his friends don't even recognize him when they get there, you know, in the next chapter. That they heard about it and they're assuming it's him, but it's like they don't even recognize who this guy is. Mm. You know,
but
that's
what does
why
it mean? She says, curse God and die. Is the understanding that if he curses God, that Yehovah will just strike him dead? Or is the understanding that he should curse God and take his life? What is the understanding here?
Well, I think, you know, just to kind of, you know, tie this together, and I mean, I don't want to, you know, the imagery, you know, some people could want to take it back to, you know, Adam and Chava in the garden, you know, because this is exactly what Satan is trying to get Job to do. He's trying to get Job to curse God, and here's his wife, you know, saying to him, well, why don't you just get over with it? You know, why live like this? And I don't think we have a really strong answer one way or the other. You know, some people can say, oh, she's being really cruel. You know, how could she say something like that to him? But on the other hand, you know, she's looking at her husband, you know, who was considered a great man of the East, which would have made her a great woman. They had all this wealth. And now she's looking at her husband living like a leper in a garbage dump, you know, scraping his skin with pot sherds. She's saying, you know what, why don't you just get it over with? You know, you can't go on living like this. So just if you curse God and die, it'll be better for you than to keep going on like this.
So in her mind, potentially she's not mocking him. Maybe in her mind she's being merciful and encouraging some sort of euthanasia in a sense.
It really could be either one. And of course, you know, once again we have a euphemism here because it doesn't say it says barech. Okay, you know, why don't you bless God and die? You know, of course, we know that that's not what actually says. You know, it's because the rabbis weren't going to write curse God in the Tanakh.
And we touched on that last week.
Right.
It says in verse 10, but he said to her, you speak as one of the foolish women. You speak as one of the foolish women speaks. Shall we indeed accept good from God, and shall we not accept adversity? And in all this, Job did not sin with his lips.
Yeah, we could get into a lot of trouble with that verse 10 because of the plural there. You speak as one of the foolish women speak. You know, he doesn't call her a foolish woman, but he compares her to other foolish women. You know, and it could just mean that, you know, she's speaking like, you know, the women that don't hold their tongues and just let whatever fly out of their mouths. But what he's doing is, you know, he goes on to talk about the idea of what, you know, are we supposed to receive good from Elohim and not receive the bad? And nothing bad crossed his lips. And so in a sense, what he's doing is he's resisting the temptation that's presented by his wife. And he talks about the idea that they have to be willing to accept both the good and the adversity from God, which is unlike most popular teachings today. Because Job doesn't say that we should wish away our troubles or live in denial or name it and claim it and grab it and blab it and...
No, you know, nor did he say, Ira. He didn't sit there and say, no, don't worry, wife. It's just Satan trying to get to me. He didn't say that either. He didn't say that.
And we're going to see later on that he never – and that's the interesting – you bring up a very interesting point, is that at this point, okay, and all through this, he doesn't attribute it to Satan. And as we move on further in the text, his issue is not with Satan. His issue is with Yehovah.
And it's wrapped up in that sentence. Shall we indeed accept good from God? Shall we also not accept adversity?
Sure, because the scriptures teach us that everything in our lives comes from Yehovah, the good and the bad. This is why I said last week that the concept of evil is kind of an abstract from a Jewish perspective, which is why this idea of Satan or Satan, capital S, as an individual, as the arch enemy of God, doesn't make any sense. Because because this idea of people don't like to consider that perspective that somehow Yehovah allows for evil, but he also gave us free will. And free will allows for that. I mean, why do we have the things that go on in the world? Why do we have evil? It's because we have free will. We could have all been robots and just done what he wanted to do, but how would that him be interacting with creation? I don't think that was really his purpose. But what we're seeing here is that everything in our lives comes from God, the good and the bad, or at least it comes with the permission of Yehovah, like we see here.
That's right.
Yeah, all of it comes with a purpose.
Amen. Amen. As we've already pointed out, and as it made clear in chapter 1, that the adversary is a servant of God. He's acting in the authority of God via the command of God. And Job understands, and in all this, Job did not sin with his lips, which just goes to show the incredible strength and integrity of Job. And so we move on. And now this... Okay, so that's his wife. There's four people that he has left in his life, and it says in verse 11, here's the other three. Now, when Job's three friends heard of all this adversity that had come upon him, each one came from his own place. Now, how do we pronounce these names? So Eliphaz.
Hatemani from Teman. Mm-hmm. We have Vildad. From Shuhi. And we have Tsofar. Right.
The Naamathite. Is that right?
Right. Naamathite, yeah.
Okay. For they had made an appointment together to come and to mourn with him and to comfort him. To comfort him, Ira. That's nice.
Yep.
And this is what you were referring to. When they raised their eyes from afar and did not recognize him, they lifted their voices and wept. And each one tore his robe and sprinkled dust on his head towards heaven. Now, what does that mean? How do you sprinkle dust on your head towards heaven?
Well, it's poetic language. So really what it's talking about is they just threw dust up in the air over their heads. I mean, it's not some grand
ritual or anything.
Grand explanation or interpretation for it.
And they sat down with him on the ground 7 days and 7 nights. And no one spoke a word to him, for they all saw that his grief was very great. Now, I have to say, actually, Ira, to me, that represents some incredible friends. And I know that we're going to find out, what is going through their minds as they begin to discuss with Job, and they do open their mouths. But with that, here you have three guys who, when they saw Job and they at first didn't recognize him and they realized it was him, they tore their robes, they cried out aloud, and they threw dust on themselves. They sat down in the dust with a man who is clearly sick and possibly contagious for all they know. I don't know, but they sat down with him 7 days and 7 nights in potentially what may be the garbage dump, and no one spoke a word. They just comforted him. They were just there for him, and even Job didn't say anything. They recognized that his grief was that great.
Right. So first what we need to look at is, because I think this is important as it relates to how great a person Job was that we read about in chapter 1, that these three friends of his, as you said, they want to come and they want to mourn for him and they want to console him. But each one of them really comes from quite a distance. From areas in the desert off to the east of Israel. So they came from the east as well. You had asked me last week, where the land of Uz is. And I said, we can't know for sure, but, my best guess was somewhere around Syria, or what was called Transjordan at the time, maybe close to Damascus. Mm-hmm. And each one of them came from that area. And so we have Eliphaz comes from Timan. It says Timani, a village in what later became Edom, or what would be modern-day Jordan. We have Vildad comes from Shuach, which is off to the east somewhere, and then we have Zophar that comes from Naamah, which is northwest Saudi Arabia. And these are all areas at the edge of the desert, and they were all areas that were associated with wisdom, which is important. We actually see this in Yirmiyahu in the book of Jeremiah. Jeremiah 49, verse 7, where it says, concerning Edom, thus says Yehovah of hosts, is there no longer any wisdom in Teman? has good counsel been lost to the prudent? Has their wisdom decayed? And so what we're talking about here is, again, these were not just friends. We have to believe that these were contemporaries of Job, and had Job been a king or at least a great tribal leader, that we're talking about the same thing in these three, that these mm-hmm. were men of great wisdom from areas that were considered areas of wisdom, and now they're bringing this kind of collective wisdom and a vast oral tradition of the sons of the East. So, you know, these guys are not, just guys off the street. So when they come, you know, we're expecting to hear great things from them, and we're expecting to hear great things from them.
That's a really good point. That's a really good point. These aren't guys from the bar. These are serious guys.
Right.
And right away we see them,
you know, slipping into this flowery poetic style of speaking that was very popular in that place, you know, in that time.
And this is that occurred to me as well as I read this. I think now this is potentially, as we discussed last week, this is potentially the oldest book in the Bible. Therefore, here we are knocking on the door of chapter 3, and the first one to speak, it is Job. And it says, "And after this, after 7 days and seven nights, Job opened his mouth and cursed the day of his birth. And Job spoke and said," and it's as if, you know, he can't say anything positive about his situation. He's clearly in anguish and grief. He's not going to curse Yehovah, but he will curse the day of his birth. And what follows, I suppose, may very well be the oldest poem in it, because this is clearly poetic writing here. This is the oldest form of biblical poetry in the Bible. Would that be fair?
Absolutely. And so first we see these guys that, you know, see him from a distance. So again, this speaks of his physical condition, that they really didn't dare to come too close because they probably recognized. And as it turned out, his skin was so disfigured that they didn't recognize him. And we see that, you know, they throw the dust in the air. And all of these are signs, you know, when I said we don't have a great interpretation, but really what they are signs of mourning that are associated with death. And so, in a sense, it's as if these good friends of Job were viewing him as if he had died already. You know, kind of the same way
he was viewing him as if he's not long for the world anyhow.
Right, exactly, like his wife did. And so they sat with him on the ground for 7 days. Now, the really interesting thing about that is that this is where the concept, and I don't know if you've ever heard about this, the concept of sitting Shiva comes from in Judaism. This idea of sitting Shiva, which is a 7-day mourning period, which I actually just went through. My father just passed away less than a month ago. And we had a right after the funeral, we went home and we were supposed to sit on these low cushions, or you're supposed to sit on low benches, sitting lower than everybody else in the house. And this is where that comes from. It comes from the idea that in mourning, that when people come to sit with us, that they're really not supposed to say anything, that they're just supposed to console us and comfort us and really wait until we're ready to speak about our situation, and then encourage us to speak about our loved ones and encourage us to speak about the you know, the people that have gone on, and remember the good things about them. And so it's a very interesting thing. I don't think most people know that. Many people maybe who didn't grow up with Jewish friends or not Jewish themselves might have been, you know, attended something like this and gone to see somebody in a mourner's house in Judaism and wondered what that it was about. And here it is. It's from this verse in the book of Job.
Wow. And so this is what he had to say when Job finally opened his mouth. And just stop me when you want to interject. It begins like this, as he curses the day of his birth. "May the day perish on which I was born, and the night in which I said, and the night in which it was said, a male child is conceived. May that day be darkness. May God above not seek it, nor the light shine upon it. May darkness and the shadow of death claim it. May a cloud settle on it. May the blackness of the day terrify it."
All right, stop there for a minute. So, so what we see is that finally, after a week together, he begins to speak. But he still avoids cursing God, but instead he curses his day, which, as we saw earlier, or as you mentioned earlier, related to those feasts could potentially be speaking about birthdays. And so it's very possible that, you know, this would support that notion that you brought forth last week about the birthdays, because here he now begins the curse. Mm-hmm. What's interesting here and why I asked you to stop is because if you could quickly turn to Jeremiah chapter 20 in your Bible, and in verse 14, and read verses 14 through 18, I think we'll see something very interesting.
Jeremiah 20, verse 14 says, "Cursed be the day in which I was born. Let the day not be blessed in which my mother bore me. Let the man be cursed who brought news to my father, saying, 'A male child has been born to you,' making him very glad. And let that man be like the cities which Jehovah overthrew and did not relent. Let him hear the cry of the morning and the shouting at noon, because he did not kill me from the womb, that my mother might have been my grave and her womb always enlarged with me." Oh my goodness, that's so. And why did I come forth from the womb to see labor and sorrow, that my days should be consumed with shame? Oh my goodness.
Right. So I brought that because look at that. Jeremiah is speaking. And I think this kind of gives us a little bit of a perspective, maybe not necessarily on the dating so much, mm-hmm. but at least we have to believe that Jeremiah knew the story, because he's using words that are almost word for word of what we read in Job. So this would have been something that would have been known. At least the story of Job would have been known. And I thought that was important to see that. Indeed. That at least they knew of one another. And it's at this point that is believed, actually, that the poetry begins, as you brought out, because when we read in verse 5, where we kind of left off, that let darkness and the shadow of death redeem it. What in the world?
So you've got redeem it. I've got claim it. You've got redeem it.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. So, and redemption is normally a word which would be associated with something that's good. Mm-hmm. Because normally we would see the concept of a kinsman redeemer in scripture.
So it's as if darkness, darkness and the shadow of death come to own that day. Is that fair?
Right. And so, normally you expect a kinsman redeemer that comes to rescue you from this kind of serious problem. However, that's not what Job is wishing. He's wishing that the ones doing the redemption of his day were darkness and the shadow of death.
Mm-hmm.
And in other words, that his birthday would be claimed by darkness and death as one of them, that in a sense that it would become like them. Mm. And then we see this kind of the blackness, let the blackness or the blacknesses, because it's actually plural, of a day terrify it. What would be the blacknesses of the day? Well, if we hearken back to what we talked about with this idea of constellations and the Malachim, the angels, and the kind of the idea of the heavenlies, it could almost make sense from a poetic sense that this is a reference to eclipses, to solar eclipses, when the earth becomes suddenly black as night the middle of daytime, mm-hmm. an event that would have been considered terrifying to people in the ancient world. Mm-hmm. They certainly don't have the understanding that we have. And so he's kind of wishing that the day of his birth would be blackened by the darkness of an eclipse.
Goodness me. And so it goes on to say, "As for that night, may darkness seize it, may it not rejoice among the days of the year, may it not come into the number of the months. Oh, may that night be barren. May no joyful shout come into it. May those curse it who curse the day, those who are ready to arouse Leviathan."
Okay, so we see in verse 6 that, he's turning to the night of his conception, mm-hmm. okay? And he's asking that it be left completely out of the calendar, so to speak, you know? That the day of his birth should, or the night of his birth, or the day of his birth shouldn't even be counted on the calendar. Mm. And that that night be barren, in other words, barren of any kind of conception. Mm. And then we have this idea of Leviathan, or what we say Leviathan in the English. And Leviathan can mean coiled or twisted. And so we see this idea of those who curse a day, okay? Curse it, those who are ready to rouse Leviathan. And those who curse a day really, to me, refers to the enchanters. These would be people that would try to weave a spell of evil over a day. And when we see this idea of Leviathan in the second half of the verse, it's always said to be some kind of enormous sea creature. And we see it described in great detail in Job chapter 41, actually, and mentioned other places in the Bible. But I think it's interesting that there's actually some fossilized remains of an ancient, I don't know, I guess you would actually use the term dinosaur for this. Mm-hmm. It's actually called Plesiosaur. Actually, the Plesiosaur was actually first discovered in the UK sometime towards the, I want to say, 1800s in there. And it actually was recognized in an area of Britain that's now dubbed the Jurassic Coast.
Truly.
And then there was actually another one that was found in 2002 that was called the Monster of Arambari, and it was discovered in 1982 at the village of Arambari in the northern Mexican state of Nuevo León. It was actually classified as a dinosaur, and this specimen is actually a very large plesiosaur that was measured at 49 feet in length.
Wow.
And then in 2008, they found fossil remains of an undescribed plesiosaur that they named Predator X, and it was unearthed in Svalbard, which is in the Arctic, like near Norway somewhere. Mm-hmm. And it also had a length of about 49 feet. They said a mass of about 99,000 pounds.
Whoa!
And with a bite force of 33,000 pounds.
Yay!
And so,
and now this is a some sort of aquatic, water-bound dinosaur.
It actually is. So plesiosaur comes from plesi, which means near, in the Greek, and sor, which means lizard. And so it was this very large aquatic kind of dinosaur-looking thing that had like flippers. That it could propel itself through the water with, and his very long tail. It didn't have any kind of tail fin. If you Google it, you'll actually see pictures of some of the fossils, but you can also see renditions of what it perhaps might have looked like at the time. And this is why when you read in Job 41, when it describes it in detail, it says, are you able to put a hook in its jaw and all these different things? You're able, it almost like talks about, are you able to put a leash on it and keep it like a pet,
Right. Well, we'll get to that, I suppose, because it does offer a little more detail when we get there. Right. And it's interesting that this creature does come up again, but it's obviously a creature that's well known, as it would be, I guess, something that if you see it every now and then in the seas or in the lakes or whatever it may be. If I remember correctly, Ira, I think it's a very long-necked and long-tailed creature with large body and flippers.
Yep.
Would have been a terrifying sight, no doubt, because of its size.
Yeah, and obviously the people knew, obviously, in that day they knew because it talks about it in detail.
There it is. May the stars of its morning be dark. May it look for light but have none, and not see the dawning of the day, because it did not shut up the doors of my mother's womb, nor hide sorrow from my eyes.
Mm-hmm. Boy. So I just want to go back for a second, because I just want to make one more point about what we just read in that verse about the enchanters and this idea of rousing Leviathan, because certainly rousing Leviathan is not a good idea.
No.
in that verse. And so what we're seeing there, I just want to bring this forth because it's a very important point as it relates to poetry, something that's called synonymous parallelism, which is one of the major forms of Hebrew poetry, where you see something that that's said in a different way but means the same thing in a verse. And so this is so we see that's what being said there is that rousing Leviathan is clearly something very foolish, if not suicidal, in that day. And this means that being an enchanter is also extremely foolish. So it's talking about, those who curse the day and those who you know, rouse Leviathan. And so in this way, Job is kind of making a negative comment about enchantment and witchcraft, even while wishing that the day of his birth was cursed. So he's actually kind of still being Jobish. You know, he's still kind of trying to be a man of integrity, you know, kind of. You know, for a while there, and then you get into that verse that you talked about.
That's an excellent point. Yeah, no, I didn't see that. That's great. Thank you for putting that together.
Yeah, and so what he's doing here is, so he let the, you know, where he starts talking about the stars being darkened, and so what we see here in verse 9 is that he's wishing the opposite for the night of his conception. So we see that he paints a beautiful picture. You know, in the second part, talking about the rays of dawn. And he paints this beautiful picture of waiting for the dawn. And certainly in that area of the world, you're gonna experience this soon, because I know you're getting ready to go to Israel. And hopefully I'm going to be there around the same time with you. So I'm excited
about
that.
I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, so having been there, I can tell you that that this picture becomes even much more attractive when you're in Israel, surrounded by areas of, you know, when the cool of the day comes. It's very dramatic, you know, the dawn in Israel as opposed to the heat of the day in certain times of the year. And certainly by crystal clear skies that we see in the desert when you're out in the desert at night. And so, in other words, he's saying, let even the most delightful part of the night, which is the first glimmer of daylight, be darkened. You know, this is how powerful it is.
And yeah, verse 10, because it did not shut up the doors of my mother's womb, nor hide sorrow from my eyes.
Right. Let that night be darkened, since it did not prevent the birth that has led to all this trouble.
But it's interesting, nor hide sorrow from my eyes. Now, from that phrase, is it possible to speculate that all of this downfall happened on the day of his birth, on his birthday?
I could say that. I could say that based on what we just read, you know, up in the verses up above.
Because it did not shut up the doors of my mother's womb, nor hide sorrow from my eyes. That day did not hide sorrow from my eyes. Is it possible?
It's possible. It's possible. I think there's enough information if we tie together the, you know, the potential for the sons having, you know, feasts on their birthday, and that we could probably make a tie into that. I wouldn't, you know, hang potential my hat on thing. It and say absolutely, potential but thing. I certainly see a potential for that. Yeah.
So verse 11, why did I not die at birth? Why did I not perish when I came from the womb? Why did the knees receive me, or why the breast that I should nurse? For now I would have lain still and have been quiet. I would have been asleep.
Right.
Then I would have been at rest.
Sure. So he, you know, he's almost saying it would have been better for me to have been stillborn.
That's pretty much what he's saying. He's giving us now he's starting to give us at least his understanding of Sheol, his understanding of what it would have been like
and what,
to
what
have
we
passed.
See, absolutely. And what we see just before that is this idea, for what reason did the knees come to meet me, and why the breasts that I might suck? There's almost you can almost make the sense that he's almost saying, it might be a little bit of a stretch, but almost talking about being illegitimate at this point. You know, like, I can't even trust my heavenly father at this point, you know, when he starts cursing the day of his birth. Because we see this concept of knees all through the Tanakh related to the legitimacy of a newborn child. We see this in Genesis chapter 30, verse 3, where Rachel, you know, talks about not having children. And then it says, she said, here is my maid Bilhah, go into her that she may bear on my knees, that through her I too may have children. And then we also see this Genesis chapter 50, verse 23, when Yosef, it says, Yosef saw the third generation of Ephraim's sons, also the sons of Macher, the sons of Manasseh, were born on Yosef's knees. I just wanted to bring that. And so, yeah, he now he gets into this concept that you read in verse 13 about this idea of sleep. For now, had I laid down and been quiet, had I slept, then there would be rest for me. So he's saying if he had died at birth, he would now be experiencing the restful condition of death. And really, the association of sleep and death was really strongly connected in the ancient Middle East. Mm. And he is introducing this idea of Sheol that you're talking about, which is that would have been considered this place of rest. We read actually later in this chapter, but in one of the later chapters, in chapter 17, verse 13, Job says, "Indeed, I have marked out my home in Sheol and spread out my couch in the darkness."
Mm-hmm.
So he is making reference to that. Mm. And to him, the greatest advantage of Sheol is he's kind of making this argument that had I been in Sheol, had I died, before I was born, I would be out of the reach of God's punishing hand.
Mm, potentially. So he goes on to say, I would have been asleep, then I would be at rest, and then he goes to talk about the company he would have been keeping with kings and counselors of the earth who build ruins for themselves, or with princes who had gold, who filled their houses with silver. Oh, why was I not hidden like the stillborn child, the infants who never saw light?
Right. And so I don't want to go too far away from this idea of Sheol here, because I think it's very important for people listening to understand this concept. I don't know if you guys went into this too much when you all, when you guys did Hell Hades.
We did touch on it. Yeah. We touched on Sheol.
Yeah. Because I think also there's another, we see later on also in verse 19, Job alludes to this in talking about a slave is free of his master, that idea that I talk about being out of the reach of the hand of Jehovah. Mm-hmm. And so when you talk about Sheol, we have quite a few texts in the Tanakh that talk about Sheol, and it's not just talking about those who depart, but there's something that's called Rephaim. We see in Isaiah chapter 14 and in the Psalms and Proverbs, and actually later on in Job we'll read it as well, Rephaim. Sometimes in the English I think it's spelled like shades or shades, S-H-A-D-E-S, which actually could mean apparitions or departed spirits.
Mm-hmm.
And we see that in Job 26:5, it talks about that the Rephaim tremble under water and its dwellers. And so I want to talk about that really quickly, because we have a prohibition against their – he already talked about this idea of enchanters. And we have a prohibition against there being among the Israelites anyone who casts spells or one who consults ghosts or familiar spirits. We see that in Deuteronomy, the idea of a prohibition against the Ov and Yidoni, which is the ghost and the familiar spirit. And this clearly tells us that this custom was prevalent. And I say that because I want people to understand that this was in that day. Remember, we talked about the touching on or brushing against paganism, that this was a natural thing to be thought of about that. As a matter of fact, it was apparently believed in that day that that there was this possibility of communion with the dead. We actually see in 1 Samuel 28. With King Shaul, the King Saul, where it says that he couldn't hear from Jehovah and he couldn't hear from the prophets or from the Urim. And what does he do in 1 Samuel 28:7? It says, "Vayomer Shaul avdav bakshuli eshet ba'alat ov." I had to bring that verse because I love where it says "ba'alat ov," because I don't know what it says in your English translation.
What I've got here is, "Then Saul said to his servants, 'Find me a woman who is a medium, that I may go to her and inquire of her.' And his servants said to him, 'In fact, there is a woman who is a medium at Endor.'"
So medium. But what I just read to you is "ba'alat ov." And what is ba'alat? Ba'alat is the feminine of Baal. And Baal can mean, it could be talking about a pagan god, but Baal can also be master.
Master, okay? Yeah.
So this is Baalat, which is feminine. So this is mistress. So she's called Baalat Ov. She's called mistress of the Ov, okay? So when we read medium, or sometimes the English translation will say the witch of Endor, they call her. But this was a Baalat Ov. This was a mistress of the Ov. This was somebody that you would have gone to, that would have tried to commune with the dead and to kind of act as a channel for the dead to speak. So while there's a definite idea in Scripture of what is of the earth will return to the earth and what is of Yehovah will return, we then see that Job allows himself to toy with the idea of life after death and is musing about Sheol as a refuge where he can hide until God's rage subsides, and then he can be called back by God. We actually see this.
Before we get off 1 Samuel chapter 28, we have to we have to touch on the fact that it is in fact Samuel that brings I think maybe the only eyewitness as to what goes on in Sheol, and he doesn't give us much detail, but he says in verse 15, "Now Samuel said to Saul." Now, of course, in Christian theology, we can't possibly let that be Samuel, and in Christian theology. In the tradition that I came from, I often heard that, oh, well, that's not really Samuel. That's a demon pretending to be Samuel. But that's not what it says. What it says is, "Now Samuel said to Saul, why have you disturbed me by bringing me up?" Well, first of all, we see that Samuel is disturbed, which means that he was at peace, at least.
You had to go there, right?
Where he was. "Why have you disturbed me? I was chilling out, all right? Yeah. I was at peace, okay? And now you've disturbed me and you've brought me up." And Saul says, "Well, I'm deeply distressed and this is happening and it's no good." And Samuel says to him, tomorrow in verse 19, "You and your sons will be with me. Yehovah will also deliver the army of Israel into the hand of the Philistines," and so on it goes. And of course, Saul, it says in verse 20, immediately Saul fell full length on the ground and was dreadfully afraid because of the words of Samuel. Clearly he's saying, "You're going to die, and you too are coming to Sheol." And there's a little bit more detail.
Yeah, and I think that's a good point to bring up when we look at the next two verses that I want to look at, which are actually from Job 14, verse 13 and 14, because it's this idea of him talking about hiding from death until a later time. It says, "Oh, that you would hide me in Sheol, console me until your anger passes. Set a fixed time for me and then remember me." And then it says in verse 14, "If a man dies, can he live again? All the days of my service, I wait until my change comes." And then Hebrew, that word in the Hebrew is chalifati. It could actually mean a change of raiment. In other words, he's talking about, look, I'm in sackcloth and ashes now, but there's a time that I'll go to Sheol, you know, conceal me in Sheol. You know, it would be better.
He's fully expecting that this is going to eventuate in his death, it would appear.
Absolutely.
And and yet, all the days of my hard service, I will wait till my change comes.
Right.
Says a lot about what they understood, even in what is potentially the oldest book in the Bible.
Yeah, exactly. So we could have a heyday with that, couldn't we?
We certainly could. We could go to a lot of it. Well, maybe when we get to that chapter,
maybe we could talk about the resurrection of the dead.
Let's talk about the resurrection of the dead when we get to Job chapter 14.
Yeah, as it relates to that. So yeah. So anyway, but and then he goes into, as you said in verse 14, with kings and council of the earth who built ruins for themselves. So in essence, he's saying that if I go down to Sheol, I'm going to be with these great people. You know, I was a great person, and you know, I'm going to be with these great people who have passed on before. You know, the idea of who built ruins for themselves. He actually could be saying that, look, you know, I know what it's like to build wealth, and you know, and now look at me now. So, you know, all that they built, you know, ended up turning to ruins anyway.
And doesn't that echo so much of, say, Ecclesiastes, for example, a lot of this is what we're reading here. It does remind me of Solomon, I have to say.
Sure, and that's one of the, of course, that's one of the things that's said. As a matter of fact, dating it to the time of Jeremiah, as I read that verses, there is some thought that it could very well be dated to a period sometime before or around the captivity, and some people want to, you know, in the before the captivity, attributed to the around the time of, Shlomo HaMelech, King Solomon.
Yeah, possible. 17. The wicked cease from troubling, and there is no and the weary are at rest. There, the prisoner rests together. The prisoners rest together, and they do not hear the voice of the oppressor. The small and the great are there, and the servant is free from his master. Why the light is given to him who is in misery, and life to the bitter of soul,
right.
who long for death but it does not come, and search for it more than hidden treasure, who rejoices exceedingly and are glad when they can find the grave.
Whew.
Man.
Talk about a picture of true misery and desperation.
Absolute misery and desperation.
Yeah, and so we saw in verse 19, which is that verse I brought where he says, and a servant is free from his master. Mm-hmm. You know, he talks about the small and great are there, talking about the fact that everybody's on even ground in Sheol. You know, mm-hmm. everything was brought to ruins. It doesn't matter. Here in death, prisoners and slaves are free from their labors and all are equal, both the small and the great. And then in verse 20, we see the first and second phrases of this verse are again in a synonymous parallelism, a relationship, because we have two ways of, you know, saying the same thing. This puts light in parallel with life, which means that light here refers to the light of the life of men.
Mm-hmm.
And so why, Job asks, does God give life at all to those who are going to suffer? This is basically what he's saying. And then we have these two verses that you brought where we have this incredible picture of misery and of desperation, talking about that they dig looking for a death more than for hidden treasure. And what are they digging for? They're not digging for treasure in the dirt, but to find a tomb that they can lay themselves in.
Mm. Now, the next verse is interesting because it says, as you said, why is light given to a man whose way is hidden and whom God has hedged in? Hedged in. Well, that reminds me of what the adversary said to God when he said, "Have you not, you know, put a hedge around him? Have you not protected him in every way?" And yet, in this way, he's saying that he's hedged in. There's no hope for him now. For my sighing comes before I eat, and my groanings pour out like water. For the thing which I greatly feared has come upon me, and we talked about that last week. And what I dreaded has happened to me.
Right, and so. This idea of a man whose way is hidden and covered over. So why is light or life given? This is what Job is asking.
Mm.
To a man whose way is hidden from God and his care. In other words, God has intentionally covered over or hidden so as not to see him or help him. That's what I think he's saying. And so we kind of get a clearer picture of Job's feelings about his own situation. In other words, that he's kind of making this argument that God has hidden him away and forgotten about him. And he's kind of saying, what good is it to have the light of life if it's covered over in darkness away from God's attention? What good is it to be alive if suffering and misery is what life brings? And then we see that his condition is so bad that he says that the sight of food actually makes him groan, that even eating has become painful for him in verse 24. And then, as I said, and I think, for me, we kind of see a motive here. He says, for the terror that I feared happened to me and what I dreaded comes to me. So he reveals, in a sense, that here he was serving God and offering the sacrifices that we saw in Job chapter 1, verse 5, that it almost seems like, with this argument, that he was doing this to prevent bad things from happening to him. We could make that argument in this. That this is a very simple, we could make the argument that it's a very simple underlying motive for much of practical religion around the world today.
Perhaps, yeah.
Yeah, this idea of to avoid problems and have a good life, but all this thing that he does is doesn't stop the horrible things from happening. Because he says, what? I was not at ease and I was not undisturbed and I was not at rest and trouble came. So it didn't bring him peace. Everything that he did, it didn't help him avoid trouble.
True.
And this is why he says, Eov, that he wished he had never been born. Because he doesn't see. He's at this point. Now think about this. We have to bring back that imagery. He's sitting there in ashes. He's sitting there in the garbage dump. He's scraping his skin with – I know you don't want to hear this, Jonah. And he's sitting there scraping his skin with a broken piece of pottery. And even he – really, at this point, after sitting 7 days with his friends, and he begins to speak, even he doesn't see a way out of his predicament. He's tried serving God as a way to avoid trouble, and it didn't work. And now he doesn't see any other possible course of action, so he despairs of life itself.
And isn't that the word, despairs?
Despairs of life.
Chapter 3 really does show a man who is in utter despair, who is in the very depths of grief, who really wishes he was that it was finished, and curses the day that he was born, because everything that all of his greatness means nothing to him now because of the depths to which he has sunk. It's as if he has achieved nothing, and he wishes that he was that he never existed. And as you said, verse 26, the final verse of chapter 3, and we're going to end it here. I am not at ease, nor am I quiet. I have no rest, but trouble comes. It happened to me. That which I was fearing greatly, that which I dreaded, has come regardless. And there he is.
Yep. And then we wait until next week when we deal with I like to say one of my favorite sayings, with friends like this, who needs enemies?
Who needs enemies? Eliphaz. He is the one who answers. The next verse is, then Eliphaz the Temanite answered and said, and we're going to find out next week what he said and what it means. Oh my goodness, poor Job. It's so depressing. I'm sorry, listeners, to leave you in the depths of Job like this, but it is a fabulous book, and we're going to work our way through it. And thank you once again, Torah teacher Ira Michelson, my friend. Thanks for coming back on The Truth to You. I can't wait to get back with you again next week when we get into chapter 4. You've been listening to Truth to You on truthtoyou.org, truth2u.org, and look forward to comments from and questions from the listeners. Until next week, dear listeners, be blessed and be set apart by the truth of our Father's word. Shalom. Oh, poor Job.
Poor Job. Poor Job. That poor guy.